The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us this morning as certified financial planner Jim Solnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome, everybody, to today's show. On today's show, we're going to answer three listener emails that have come in. We've got kind of a flurry of emails lately. We're also going to tackle one of the more common questions that we receive, and it is essentially, what if I don't need my required minimum distribution that comes out of my IRA? We're going to teach you what things you might consider doing that will save you on taxes in the future. So you do have to take that RMD, but what you do with it, there's a lot of creative things. So again, welcome to today's show. Good morning, afternoon, and evening, Jim.
Good morning, afternoon, and evening, Chris.
This is a, I say it like that because this show is going to play live for the first time on September 3rd, 2016, at 8 o'clock in the morning, Mountain Time.
Labor Day weekend. And, how many people are going to listen live?
Not so many is my guess, but it'll also be up later after that on iTunes and on our website. And so depending on when you're listening to it, it could be any time of the day. Right now for us, it is mid-afternoon in Fort Collins, Colorado.
And for our Coloradoan listeners, we are not live today because it is a holiday weekend. We wanted to take the time off. And that essentially means we succeeded in not doing any more live shows for July or August.
I didn't know that was a goal, but we achieved it.
Well, when we weren't getting any calls, as you remember, you were crying and complaining and otherwise.
Crying? Yeah, well, I was just recommending a more efficient use of our time.
And I got kind of used to taking Saturday mornings off,
which I had
for a while, years. And it was nice to have a Saturday morning off.
Yeah,
it was interesting. Felt new again. So we decided to actually try to come in, but if we had something to do, we would do that instead. And we successfully found something to do every Saturday morning in July and August.
True. Moving into winter, though, things might
fall and
change
winter,
around
we may
bit.
Have some more free time, although I will be hunting in the fall, so that is going to take up some of my Saturdays and Sundays. But we hope to start bringing back live shows in September for our local Coloradoan listeners. They can, is it Coloradoan or Coloradin?
Coloradin.
That's what I thought. Someone
Coloradoan is a newspaper.
Yeah, that's.
I was going to let that one slide because it kind of was under your breath.
I picked up on it only because recently I was in Denver last week or the week before, and I was talking to some people I had met at a social event, and one was a native, and I mentioned Coloradoan, and she said, "Excuse me?" And I says, "Coloradoans." She says, "No, Coloradans." And I was
It's not just me who apparently just people
strangers,
randomly
random
in the
strangers.
Public.
Well, she took it personally. You know how natives are. They're a feisty little bunch of people because they hate everyone else who moved in. And she just had to correct me that it's Coloradans.
I don't view it so much as correcting you as maybe preventing you from saying it in the future and looking foolish.
No, she was correcting me. She had no no conceptions of Jimisms.
Oh, did you tell her you have a whole list of those things you could share with her if you could have her email address?
No.
Okay.
So, anyways, I learned something new. Coloradan. I always thought the Fort Collins newspaper, for those who don't know, Itunians and people outside of Fort Collins, the name of their newspaper is the Coloradan.
Coloradoan.
Coloradoan. Mm-hmm. I thought that's what Coloradoans were called.
No.
So how the heck did they get the name for that paper?
I don't know. Maybe they didn't want to be confused with the person.
I don't know. But anyway, so she corrected me on that. But
well, I like her already.
I don't even know who she is. I don't remember her name. I just know she was a native, and she didn't take too kindly to someone from Boston butchering the verbiage you use to describe someone from the state of Colorado. But anyways, we hope to be...
We used to call them greenies. That's the slang term, just so you know.
Well, it's because you were from Wyoming.
Right. And they have those obnoxious green license plates that would come and infect our fine state that was free of congestion and smog and things. And then we just felt they were infringing upon our space.
Well, you could move back there if you'd like.
I'm one now, so that's all good.
You can move back to Wyoming. No one is going to care.
Well, there's plenty of room there.
There is plenty of room in Wyoming. Plenty of wind.
That's true.
Plenty of room. Mm-hmm. I will admit that. Yep. So anyways, we will hopefully be live in September, October sometime. And as it gets more into winter and there's not much to do on a Saturday morning anyways, we'll probably do far more live shows. But again, if people don't call, maybe we'll take the winter off too on Saturday mornings. I kind of am enjoying having a Saturday morning free.
Well, I think more and more people are getting used to emailing us and then they can do that at their leisure.
Oh my goodness, we get...
I think that's what's taking the place of the calls, which we don't have to be live in the studio to receive an email. So that's works out for both of us.
We still have three more. One that came in fresh today, August 30th. Another one that came in August 11th. And the other one came in August 13th.
At least we're fairly caught up.
Fairly. Except I feel bad for the people on the 11th and 13th because we're also going to answer the one from today.
Well,
that person didn't have to wait at all.
No.
So today is August 30th, even though you are listening to this on September 3rd.
Or sometime thereafter.
Or sometime thereafter for those iTunians who are listening. And again, anybody who has a question, be it a local Coloradan or a Wyomingite, is that what...
Or a Georgian.
Georgian. What, someone from Wyoming, are you called Wyomingites?
Cowboys.
Right. No, seriously, what do you call someone from Wyoming?
I don't call them. I don't know.
You grew up there.
We didn't call each other.
Massachusetts.
Hey, nice
already,
to meet you.
I already
Wyoming
told you what Massachusetts people are called, right? Massholes.
Right. Yeah.
What are Wyomingites called? Wyomingites.
Friend. I don't know. Maybe. I've never had to refer to them in the third person. So.
Because I'm trying to think in my mind, because I'm just so used to calling people from Massachusetts massholes. What do you call someone from Massachusetts?
Isn't there something about beans, like beanhead or bean something? Because of the Boston baked beans?
No, but it somehow has to tie into the name of the state. Like a Texas person is a Texan. A Georgia person is a Georgian.
So you don't suppose it's a Massachusettsian?
Massachusettsian? I don't think it's Massachusettsian.
I'll look it up.
There's got to be something you call someone.
I'll look it up.
You look it up. And at the same time, tell me what someone from Wyoming is called. It's Wyomingite.
It probably is. Sounds reasonable.
Sounds reasonable to me. Okay, but anybody throughout the country, no matter...
Sheep herder.
There are more cow people up there with cows.
A lot of sheep, more sheep even, though.
Is there sheep? Yeah. All right. Okay, so anybody can email us a question, and we like it. It gives us fodder to talk about on the radio, gives us things to research and learn. As I try to point out to everyone, we don't charge for this. We don't charge for answering email questions. We don't even charge for answering questions on the radio if you call into a live show. But we also run businesses. I run a business, a financial planning practice. We specialize in retirement planning. So I am very busy with that. Chris teaches financial planning at Colorado State University, and he also has a wife and six kids, so he's tight on time as well. So we don't necessarily get to them the minute we receive the email, but we do try to get to them eventually and answer them. And Chris is keeping track. We have a map of the United States behind us. He was excited when I said we were going to get into three more email questions this week. All three are from states we already have. Mm-hmm. Pennsylvania, New York, and don't tell me the third one. I should remember this. We just went over Pennsylvania, New
Peaches.
York. Peaches. Georgia.
Exactly.
Okay. So did you find what you were looking
for? I did. So Wyomingites is acceptable as a term for natives or inhabitants of Wyoming. Wyomingan would work, and a Wyoming is
Wyoming.
Also
okay.
Is also, that's a little better. The Massachusetts one's a little concerning. Massachusettsan, that's it. Massachusettsan, I'm never saying that again. A Bay Stater.
Because we are called the Bay mm-hmm. State.
Or a Massachusite.
Or a Mass Hole.
That's too. Bay Stater seems like the least obnoxious.
Because it's the easiest to pronounce.
Yeah.
The other ones that. Are quite hard. But anybody who grew up in the East, especially.
Ooh, someone from Delaware.
A Delawarean?
Delawarean or Delawarean? A Muskrat.
Muskrat.
I'm just going by the list here.
How about Colorado?
Although Coloradan and Coloradoan are both listed. So
oh,
that lady,
so mm-hmm. this little snooty native mm-hmm, who corrected yeah. me herself was wrong.
Yeah. Well, Coloradan is listed first. That's probably the preferred. So she's a conservative in her dialect.
I wish I Googled it when I was there. I would have slammed yeah. her a new
well,
one.
You have a smartphone.
I didn't you think of Googling it. Of she was just that. Too busy correcting me. She was nice about it, but she's like, get it right.
Wow. Okay.
Okay.
Glad we covered that on the Retirement and IRA show.
Hope she doesn't listen to the show. Next time I see her out and about, she's going to be upset. Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't know which one to do first. Why don't we do the
relatively short one, because we've already eaten up a bunch of time in the first segment. Pick a short one.
Well, the short one is the one we're not going to answer.
Just pick one. I'll cut you off if it goes too long.
Well, we'll do this, the two-part one. Oh, here comes my coffee.
Well, don't stop the radio show for that.
Well, it concerned me. Thank you. For those who don't know, I order out and have Starbucks delivered, and they just brought me my coffee.
Sorry,
Chris. This is a live show.
It's called spoiled is what that is.
I'm not spoiled. You could have had a coffee.
You were spoiled. Way before you got to Colorado.
If you had staff, you would have a coffee mm-hmm. delivered to you as well.
Apparently, I'm sure I would.
Okay, so I got my coffee. I'm ready to go. Mm-hmm. All right. So we did receive a question today, a two-part question. Mm-hmm. The first, she thought we made a mistake on our blog post, our Social Security blog post. And we did do some research, and we don't feel we did make a mistake, and we're going to explain that to her. And we think
I'll admit we could have gone into greater detail.
Correct. Absolutely.
But the type of detail that might have been a little overwhelming for a blog post. But,
absolutely. But so she was 100% correct, and we want mm-hmm. to clear the air on a few things. Mm-hmm. And we do appreciate her email. Wonderful mm-hmm. email.
I didn't
we
mind
want,
getting it at all.
We want. Oh, that's what I was getting into. Anybody mm-hmm. throughout the United States, especially a state we don't have a star on, which to Chris is anywhere west of the Mississippi. If you could write to us and in your email put the state you're writing from, that would be wonderful. And we will answer your question as we are from this New York listener. We always protect people's privacy, and we're going to not use her real name. We're going to call her Georgette from New York.
Just what I always wanted, my own little bunny rabbit. I will name him George, and I will hug him and pet him and squeeze him.
I'm not a bunny rabbit.
And she has a two-part question. So we're mm-hmm. going to get into the Social Security part first, and then we'll get into the QLAC part second. She had a second question on QLACs. Okay, so she began, and I'm not going to read the whole part of her because it's a very long email. What had happened is in 2012, she was on the Social Security's website looking at her earnings records, mm-hmm. and she noticed a mistake in 2012. And she wrote, in 2012, I worked at a job and got a W-2. I'd paid taxes and Social Security as anyone in any typical job would. However, the Social Security website never updated those earnings. So I called them and they told me to wait another year and see if it gets posted.
So just for everyone's information, typically that'll post and update on your earnings record by about March or so for the prior year after they're sure they've gotten all the documentation from employers that report these earnings. So she clearly was checking on it sometime in 2013 because it definitely wouldn't have shown up before about March, February or March of 2013.
Right. And we always recommend for listeners and to people who work with us to go to Social Security's website, create your user ID profile, and every year check your earnings to make sure they're right. Now, your earnings that you pay taxes on in Social Security, let me rephrase that. The earnings that you're going to see on your 1040 are not necessarily the earnings that will appear on Social Security's website. They're only going to show you the earnings of which Social Security taxes are owed on. So they're only going to show you that if you received capital gains or if you received interest, if you received rental income, things that aren't subject to Social Security taxes, even though they'll be on your 1040 earnings, they're not necessarily going to be on the Social Security website's earnings. So you're really only going on there to check and make sure every year, like this listener did, she was from our blog listener, as she did in 2012. So in 2012, she notices there's a mistake. She doesn't see the earnings for 2012. Now, I don't know if she logged on in 2013 or if she was on in 2012, but at some point in time, she logged on and didn't see those earnings, and she contacted Social Security right away. Mm-hmm. This is going to be very key to her question. So she contacts Social Security right away. And what she then did is waited a year. She goes on to say she waited a year and it still didn't post. Okay, so what she then wrote into, she said, I am now turning 62. And remember, folks, this started in 2012. It's now 2016, 4 years later. I am now turning 62 and I think I need to get this fixed. So I went to the Social Security office near me with all my info, pay stubs, tax returns, and a W-2. So she's going into the Social Security office, folks, now, 2016, 4 years later, but she's going in with a W-2, with a pay stub, and her tax returns. And she went on to say, they fixed it in 3 days. She said, however, I was on your website, and she's talking about our Social Security blog, helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. I was on your website, and you stated that a Social Security error must be corrected in 3 years. And I corrected this well over 3 years later. And then she wrote, I thought it would not be corrected, and I almost didn't look into it. In other words, she felt she was past the three-year limit. They're not going to bother fixing this. Why even bother? And she writes, she's glad she did because she got it fixed. Okay, so what she wanted to point out to us is that, so if, and she wrote, I don't want someone who doesn't get the credit they deserve because of misinformation, and I know you would feel very badly. So she's trying to help us. Mm-hmm. And Chris went back and looked at the blog post to which she was referring. And in the one thing I want to point out before Chris takes over, because it was his blog post, and he's going to explain why they fixed this woman's after the deadline. There is a deadline, and our blog post is correct on that. But in our written blog post, we just alluded to you have to fix it in 3 years.
Generally.
Generally.
It says most earnings record errors have a statute of limitation of 3 years. Which is true.
Which is true. And actually, if you listen to the audio part of the blog post, we get into the specific number. It has to be fixed within 3 years, 3 months, and 15 days.
From the end of the tax year in question.
Correct.
So her 2012, she'd have 3 years, 3 months, and 15 days normally from the end of 2012 in order to fix
it. So she would have had 2013, 14, 15, all the way to April 15th. Mm-hmm. Which is tax filing day, people, April 15th, not January, February, March, yeah, April 15th
of 2016.
Of 2016.
Mm-hmm. So she missed it. If she just did it recently, she did miss
correct.
That limit
she did
by
miss
a few
that
months.
Limit. Mm-hmm. But they fixed it, people, and she wanted to let us know that she got it fixed past that 3-year, 3-month, and 15-day deadline, and then she wants us to update our blog post so no one else makes a mistake. We are going to do a new blog post on this because we find this topic fascinating, but what we want to get her to know is why was it fixed? Well, it was fixed because there are exemptions to that 3-year, 3-month, and 15-day time limit, and we feel she could qualify for one of two of the, I think, 8 or 9 exemptions. It could be one of two. We don't know which one it is because this was done via an email. So hopefully I set the stage for the people, listeners. And then, Chris, why don't you explain what we think happened here?
Okay. So Jim is right. Generally, you've got that 3-year, 3-month, and 15-day limit. And that's why we encourage people to check their earnings record periodically. I think it's a good idea to try to do it every year, but even if you do it every couple years, you should catch any errors before they get so old that you have trouble fixing them. Now, even though there's that limit, there is a list of approximately 9 main excuses, if you will, where your earnings record could be revised or fixed past that time limit. I'm not going to read through all 9 of them. Some of them are very kind of convoluted and might only apply to 1 in a million people. But there's a couple here that would apply probably to a number of people and probably applied to this particular listener. So here's the number one.
And just as you're looking for that, what I want our listeners to know, the 3-year, 3-month, and 15-day limit is a pretty hard limit. However, if you qualify for one of these exemptions, there's pretty much an open time limit.
Right.
But you have to qualify for these exemptions. And we feel the operative thing was what she did. We feel we know which exemption she qualified for. Although it could be one of two, we have a feeling we know which one it is.
So the first of the two is you're contacting them to add wages paid in a period by an employer who made no report of any wages paid to the worker. So essentially it's possible they gave her a W-2, but then never bothered to actually file it on the other end with the IRS.
And this happens.
Which then forwards the information to the Social Security Administration.
I have read about companies that do this. They're trying to defraud the government over paying the payroll taxes.
Exactly.
And they either underreport your salary or they don't report it. And
right. So that might have been the case where she had the W-2, but the employer never reported it. That's one possibility. The other one, though, that we're probably betting that is the case: prior to the expiration of the time limit, the worker or the worker's survivor has requested a revision of his or her earnings record for a particular year. So as long as you've contacted them and brought it to their attention, if they take too long to fix it, which is kind of what she described, she contacted them, they said, wait a year. And then she contacted them again, still wasn't fixed. Then they strung her along. Then she brought in proof. And they look, oh, you've been talking to us about this for a while. You get in under the wire.
And that's the one,
probably the case.
Probably the one, because, again, she had the job, folks, in 2012. She doesn't tell us when she checked her earnings, but we're just guessing she checked sometime in 2013. That's why they said wait a year. And I'm guessing, Chris, she did it. Excuse me. She checked early in 2013, and they said, well, wait a year, and it should be there. And then she checked again, and it wasn't there, but she never got back a hold of Social Security at that point. And then later, as she got close to 62, she thought, you know, I should tell them about this because it's not there. Well, the mere fact that she contacted them within that 3-year, 3-month, and 15-day period, that is what saved her. Because she contacted them within the timeline, even though it didn't get fixed till after, that's immaterial. She contacted them within that timeline. And we did not explain all this in our original blog post on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, so we're going to update it with a little more information on how you can dispute an earnings record.
Excellent. So the music means we're at the end of our first segment here. When we come back from our short break, we are going to hear one of the top songs from 1935, which we all know at this point, listening to the show. That is the year that Social Security started. And the hint is this week's 1935 song features a rare matchup between this famous crooner and the Dorsey Brothers Band.
A crooner?
Crooner.
What state are they from?
No, that's a style of singing, Jim.
Oh, I thought sooner was can't. I thought, okay, crooner.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
So we'll cover that when we get back from the short break.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Am I dreaming or am I awake? I can't believe my eyes. Is it really true?
Well, welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. Here's one of the top songs from 1935, the year that Social Security was created. And that one is Without a Word of Warning by Bing Crosby. It's a ballad that he sang for Joan Bennett in Two for Tonight, which was a movie, and the band in the background is the Dorsey Brothers Orchestra, before they broke up and went their separate ways. Do you recognize that one, Jim?
I recognize the voice. No,
I don't recognize your voice because you don't have your microphone on.
Oh. Better?
Much better.
Okay. We shut them, for those who don't know, in between every break, we shut the microphone off so we can talk. And
some of us remember to turn it back on.
Some of us remember to turn it back on. Some of us don't. Mm-hmm. And I'd fall into the don't category.
But you sure got your coffee delivered.
I did. I always remember to order my coffee from Starbucks and get it delivered. Yeah. You're just jealous that you don't get
priorities.
It delivered.
Yeah. Okay. So are we going to cover the second part of that email question?
We
dealt with an email this last segment. If you missed it, it was an email regarding the statute of limitations on correcting an error on your earnings record with Social Security. And while it's generally 3 years, 3 months, and 15 days, which is a bizarre length of time, but that is the rule. 3 years, 3 months, and 15 days from the end of the tax year in which the earnings should have been reported, there are some exceptions. And we had a listener that had written to us that had fallen under one of those exceptions. And I wanted to point that out, that we hadn't talked about it on our helpwithmysocialsecurity.com blog that we run. So we chatted with that, and we promised that we will actually update the blog post to include a lot of these exceptions which really weren't talked about in our original post.
Exactly. And if that listener is still listening, well, Hope should be listening, because I'm going to email her today and tell her it'll be on Saturday's show, okay. And I'm sure she's going to want her answers.
Nice.
Let us know where we write on our assumption that if the Social Security office said anything to her of why they were going to fix it. We think it's because of, out of the 9 exemptions, we think that's the exemption that probably applies. Mm-hmm. Well, they may not even have told her.
They probably didn't. They probably just did it and didn't want to go into the fact that they strung her along without fixing it.
Because really, it's their fault. They dropped the ball. Yeah. She contacted them about it. They dropped the ball, and they're fixing it. But to me personally, you qualified for exemption 9 on the list from the Social Security website. That was the 9th exemption, to me, that's the one she qualifies on. Which makes sense. What if she walked in there in 3 years, 3 months, and 14 days?
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to get this fixed within 1 day, but because she got in there before the deadline, they're going to fix it.
Yep.
So anyways, that's the exemption that I think. Okay. Then she went on to write in the third paragraph of her email.
Brand new topic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Regarding your show on QLEX, and for those who don't know, this is Chris's favorite shows. Were the three.
My favorite part about them is they're in the past now.
We may resurrect them.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid of.
You know, Tales from the Crypt.
Maybe we should do that on a best of weekend.
for those who want to binge listen to the right. Retirement and IRA right. show. We did a series of shows, three as a matter of fact. Chris makes it sound like we did
in a
30.
Row.
They were three shows on qualified longevity annuity contracts. So I need to just briefly, I mean, and for me that's going to be hard, but I need to be very quick and explain what a QLAC is, because if you don't know what they are, you're not going to understand this question.
Perfect.
But a QLAC is a type of annuity that was actually created by the federal government. And the federal government they don't underwrite the annuities. They don't issue these annuities. They created the rules that created these annuities. Prior to the federal government, the Department of Treasury coming out after the market crashed in 08 and 09, a lot of people were, you know, hurting financially, obviously. And the federal government was trying to look at, well, what are some of the things we can do to help protect people? Well, people, when the markets tanked, retirees were being decimated, and some people were running out of money, Chris. Mm-hmm. And the government was saying, well, we got to encourage more people to own income annuities for more people to be able to pass on the risk of their portfolios reaching zero and to get some lifetime stream of income. Well, the problem is annuity held inside an IRA ran into all sorts of problems with required minimum distribution rules. And it was hard to own what is known as a deferred income annuity inside an IRA. A deferred income annuity is where the younger you, whether you are 50, 60, 65, it doesn't matter, the younger you buys this annuity. You give some money to the insurance company, and the insurance company promises you at some point in the future to begin paying you a certain amount of money every year, no matter how long you live. And then people who have longevity, you buy these if you have longevity. You buy these if you think you're going to live a long time.
Or if you just want to protect yourself against the risk of living a long time.
Correct. But if you know for certain longevity is in your life, if you are 70 and you're still tango dancing with your dad who's 98, you might want to buy a longevity product. But some people, Chris, may not have longevity. They may have some medical conditions and they don't feel they're going to live past their 80s. Mm-hmm. Then you may not need a long-term income annuity. But nonetheless, the government said, well, wait a minute. We created all these rules with IRAs, and it's impossible for someone to put a deferred income annuity inside an IRA because we forced them at age 70 and a half to start taking money out. So they created what they term, you know, the government has an acronym for everything. So they created an acronym QLAC, QLAC. And they said to the industry, look, we're going to allow you to create a totally new annuity. You're going to call that annuity a QLAC. QLAC stands for Qualified Longevity Annuity Contracts. And if your annuity does certain things, we will allow that annuity to be held inside an IRA. And when that annuity owner reaches 70 and a half, they don't have to take required minimum distributions from that QLAC IRA. They don't have to do it. They can defer it up to age 85. That's a lot longer than 70 and a half. Now, there's a lot of rules with these. We're not getting into them. If you want to know more about QLACs than you ever imagined, just go to our website. If I think the easiest way is go to my business website, Jim Helps. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S. Go to jimhelps.com. About maybe two-thirds down the website, if you scroll down, you're going to see a link to our radio show website and a link to our Social Security blog. Click the link to our radio show website. There's a big picture there of me, Chris, and Pete, just and an icon for our radio show. Just click that. It'll take you right to our radio show website. There is a search box on the radio show website. I forget if it's in the center or the upper right, but you'll see it. It says search. Inside the box, type QLAC. Don't write the word QLAC, a qualified longevity annuity contract. Just put QLAC in the search box, click search, and the three shows will pop up and start listening to them in any order, but I recommend 1, 2, and 3 in a row, but you can listen to them in any order you want, and it'll teach you more on QLACs. Okay, so this...
Well, I have, just so you know, I have found the office, the governmental office that comes up with all these acronyms. It's called the GOAT office.
Are you making this up?
It's the Governmental Office on Acronym Titles.
And they call themselves GOAT?
GOAT.
I mean, I don't know if you're pulling my leg or you're totally serious. Are you totally serious? There's a department of the government called the GOAT.
Government Office on Acronym Titles. G-O-A-T, GOAT.
Okay.
They have an acronym for themselves.
It's a cute acronym.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't believe you. Because you've done this to me before, tried to make me look. I'm not falling for this. No. Listeners, you take that for your own discretion if there is actually the Department of GOAT.
It makes sense
because the government will have an acronym for everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it very well could be, and you know, they have a sick sense of humor, so they might be, yeah, let's call ourselves the GOATs, the Governmental Office for Acronym Titles, or whatever
and
you say.
And they have, you know, they wear blazers, they have that little badge, that insignia, round with the billy goat head sticking out of it.
Now I know you're screwing with me. But they very well could be the Department of GOAT. Because we've often asked on this show, who comes up with these acronyms?
They're good at it.
They're very,
very
good
prolific.
At it. Okay, so she has a question on them, so let me get to it. She writes, if a person buys a QLAC, and then it's hard to... when a person buys a QLAC for expenses, they will need an old age. I think what she's saying, I'm going to buy it now, but I'm going to use it to pay for expenses in old age. Mm-hmm. If a person buys a QLAC for expenses, they need an old age. When the money is dispersed to you, is it in the form of taxable money? Or would they pay the money directly to you? And by they, she means the insurance company. Would the insurance company pay the money to you? And you get a tax bill and will have to pay the taxes. So she wants to know, how is the money dispersed? And then she writes, or is the money non-taxable? And I wish that was the truth.
That'd be nice.
That would be nice. So you can always understand. The answer to that part is going to be no. And then she wrote, I thought a QLAC is opened with IRA money and therefore has not been taxed. Mm-hmm. Okay. So she's a little confused on how the taxation of a QLAC would work. Mm-hmm. And then she wrote, you also said if you die before using a QLAC, you will get all the money back. You don't get the money back. You're dead. Your beneficiaries will get the money back. But she wrote...
With the right QLAC, though, correct?
Correct.
There are QLACs that don't pay all the money back.
I'll get right into that. Mm-hmm. Then she said, how will that be taxed? Can you be more explicit on the taxation of QLACs? Okay. So let me just explain a little bit about the taxation of QLACs so she'll have this all down pat. QLACs are opened in an IRA. You do not open a QLAC in a Roth IRA. A Roth IRA can't hold a QLAC. A QLAC inside a Roth IRA is not a QLAC. Now, inside a Roth IRA, you could put a deferred income annuity, which we've often said are the cousins of QLACs. QLACs were founded on the chassis of a deferred income annuity. Because Roth IRAs don't have any required minimum distributions whatsoever, the government doesn't care what you put in those because you don't have to take your money out. But inside an IRA or a 401k, that's where you would own a QLAC. And those accounts, for the most part, have never been taxed. Some people will have after-tax money inside their IRAs or inside their 401ks. But that's not all the time, and we won't spend a lot of time on that
nuance. It's pretty rare, I'd say.
It can happen, but it's not common. It's not as common as you think. So because your IRA has never been taxed, all distributions from a QLAC will be taxable to you.
Mm-hmm.
So the QLAC you will have to pay tax on. She wanted to know, do you get a tax bill? Or do they, meaning the insurance company, do they send the taxes to the government?
Right, like withholding, as an employer might do, withhold taxes, send them in on your behalf. So you just get the net amount, and then you, when you file your taxes, the IRS has already gotten some or all of the taxes, or maybe more of the, more than the taxes that you owe, and that's why you file a tax return to reconcile that.
And I'm going to answer this. In the case of an IRA, the choice is yours. Mm-hmm. When you open the QLAC, they're going to ask you, do you want us to withhold the taxes, or do you want to withhold the taxes? Most people that I work with, if not all, I don't want to say all because I'm sure someone at some point in time checked the other box, but most people will check the box that says withhold taxes, and they will put in the amount they want the insurance company to withhold because it's easier. If you don't do that, you will probably have to start paying quarterly taxes on your own and mailing in a check every quarter to the government. And remember, you're going to be in your 80s or 90s, and you're not going to be doing that.
Right. So, and if you don't do that, if you just let it wait for the whole year, you can put yourself in a position of having tax penalties for not sending your taxes in during the year on a, in a timely basis.
Absolutely. So we don't want anyone to get exposed to a tax penalty. So the first part, how are the taxes done there? Well, again, it's your choice. Then she wanted to know essentially about this death benefit.
Well, before you said that, you said in an IRA, it's your choice. But what about in a 401k?
Well, a 401k would be a little different. There's a lot. I'm not a fan of QLACs inside 401ks. They're very hard to find. And because you, I don't want to get, see, I'm going to end up going down a rabbit hole here. But if you have four 401ks and you would have to open four QLACs. Right. Whereas if you had four IRAs, you only have to open one QLAC, make it a little easier.
But when you take a distribution
from a 401k, they will automatically withhold 20% taxes and send it to the IRS. So if you have a QLAC inside a 401k, they're going to send the taxes for you. But every QLAC that I have seen have been in IRAs, not inside 401ks. And I don't even know of any QLACs yet being offered inside 401ks. Okay. Next question that she wanted to get to is this option that if you don't use your money, you will get it back. First of all, I might use the verbiage, you will get it back. But what I'm really saying is your beneficiaries will get it. You have passed away. When you buy a QLAC, it's an irrevocable decision. You cannot close the QLAC during your life and say, just give me my money back. I don't want to do this anymore. When you buy a QLAC, you are buying longevity insurance. That's what a QLAC is. A QLAC is sold to you from an insurance company. You go to an insurance company to buy insurance. You do not go to an insurance company to buy an investment. Just like when you go to King Soopers, which is a grocery store here in Colorado, you're buying groceries. I have a coffee here on the desk from Starbucks. I go to Starbucks to buy coffee. I don't go to Starbucks to buy insurance. I don't go to King Soopers to buy well, I actually do buy coffee in King Soopers. There's Starbucks all over King Soopers now. But you go to a grocery store essentially to buy groceries. You go to a coffee shop to buy coffee. You go to an insurance company to buy insurance. So if you are buying a QLAC, you best say, hey, I think I'm going to live longer than life expectancy. I think if I'm a woman, I am going to live longer than 87. And if I'm a man, I'm going to live longer than 85. Or you may not be certain you're going to live that long, but you want to protect yourself, as Chris said, from the risk of living too long. That's why you buy a QLAC, because it will pay you a good amount of money relative to what you put in for the rest of your life later in life. So it's going to give you a little backstop. You're now 80, 85 years old. Your money might be running out. And then, boom, this QLAC turns on and all of a sudden it starts paying you more money. So you're going to buy it for longevity purposes. But there's always a risk, Chris. You'll do what?
You'll pass away earlier than expected or even before it starts or just a little bit into after the QLAC starts paying out. And at that point, you will have paid out a lot more than you received, And while you have passed away and aren't really going to be worried about it, your beneficiaries will look at the situation and think, boy, that was a dumb idea. They outlaid X amount of dollars and they got just pennies on those dollars or maybe nothing back at all.
Right.
And you can avoid that with specific types of QLACs.
Now, if you purchase a QLAC, there are two options. We get into this in a lot of depth in our three QLAC shows, but the short of it is the money is going to be taxable to your beneficiaries. And she wanted to know, how is it paid? Well, if you pass away before income begins, before you begin taking your income, your beneficiaries will receive the QLAC payment in a lump sum. And what it is equal to is only a return of your premium. That is it. And that is a rule that the Department of Treasury put in there. There will be no earnings on the return of premium, just the return of premium. So if you opened up a QLAC at age 60 with $100,000 and you passed away at age 80 before getting any money out, let's say you were going to wait to 85 to turn it on, which is the longest you can defer a QLAC, your beneficiaries will inherit the $100,000. Mm-hmm.
And owe tax on that because it hasn't yet been taxed.
Correct. But if you pass away after the payments begin, now that is another option, and you have to choose that option. You have to choose the first option. It's called return of premium. And that is something you have to specifically ask for. Some QLAC companies don't give you any choice. It's always a return of premium. Others will let you choose. Do you want this return to premium feature or not? If you don't take it, you will get more money while you're alive, but you don't get anything if you pass away. After you pass away is another option. That is not, it's no longer a return of premium. It's what they call a cash refund. Once income begins, they will give as a cash refund, a lump sum payment to your beneficiaries equal to the difference between what you put in and what you received before dying. So if you put in $100,000, received just $60,000 and then passed away, the $40,000 is sent as a lump sum payment. Because you have passed away after your required minimum, your required beginning date, rather, which is April 1st of the year following the year you turn 70 and a half. Now, don't even bother remembering that. If you passed away anywhere past age 70 and a half, essentially, into your 80s and 90s, that lump sum payment is received in one. There's no stretching it out. So that will be paid to your beneficiaries in a big distribution because it's coming from an IRA. Remember, there's an IRA there. Now, if you pass away before April 1st of the year following the year you turn 70 and a half, so you, in other words, you pass away in your 60s, that money can be stretched out like a regular IRA payment. However, after your required beginning date, a QLAC payout cannot be stretched out, even if inherited by a spouse. It is the RMD for that year, and that RMD has to be taken. So the final QLAC payment, if you passed away, will most likely not be able to be deferred at all because chances are you're going to take this after age 70 and a half. That's the whole idea of a QLAC. And you buy them so you don't have to take any required minimum distributions until age 85. So just remember that to the listener. It will be taxed, the lump sum payment, and it's not going to be able to be stretched out. You're going to have to pay taxes on that. Or not you, but your beneficiaries, as the year of death required minimum distribution. That's what they will consider it. And it's going to be received in a big check. So if you bought a QLAC at 60, we're going to delay it to age 85 and passed away at 80, there's a $100,000 distribution right there.
So they prevent essentially a QLAC from continuing to pay the yearly amount, say a person passed away before receiving all of the premiums that they put in, they've stopped the option or didn't allow the option of those payments continuing on for some period of time for your beneficiaries.
Well, they could if you named a joint a QLAC. You can get a joint QLAC.
Ah, yes, but just a single, just a plain old one.
She wasn't talking about
that. Because that would kind of defy the concept of banning the stretch.
Now, a husband and wife, and not that it could be even a non-spouse,
right.
You can open a joint QLAC. So I want to make that clear to her. And if that was the case at her death, if it was a joint payout, you put in $100,000 and let's say it was going to pay you beginning at age 80, $5,000 a year for the rest of your... No, it would be more than that. $10,000 a year for the rest of your life at age 80. And you made it as a joint one with your husband. Even if you died, those payments will just continue as if nothing happened. But I was trying to explain if she took out a QLAC on her own life and it was looking to pay a lump sum death benefit, that is taxable in the year received, which would be December 31st of the year following her death. Just one big lump sum, no stretch out, totally taxable.
Got it. So when we come back from this next short break, we're going to hear the number one song from this week in 1976. And this was the first chart topper for this brother-based band. And it... 1976, of course, we're getting deep into disco, so
Doobie Brothers.
Jim's going to all excited about
hearing
this. Those
Australian guys with the big hair.
Well, maybe. So we'll hear who that is right after this short break.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That is the number one song from this week in 1976, which is 40 years ago, for those of you keeping track. That is, of course, You Should Be Dancing by the Bee Gees. It became one of the biggest disco hits of all time. It was featured prominently in the movie Saturday Night Fever with John Travolta. And Travolta is the one who recommended that You Should Be Dancing be used instead of the song originally chosen for that dance scene that's so famous. That song was Night Fever, but this one got subbed. John Travolta was a genius, apparently. And yes, they are those guys from Australia. This is the same time period, by the way, that Barry Gibb took 10 months to work on that falsetto style of his voice. He changed. He trained himself to do that, and then... Wow, he's famous. Thanks for joining us, Jim.
No problem.
I was just sitting here talking to myself.
You're doing very good.
Okay.
I was looking something up. Mm-hmm. Why don't you explain to our listeners why we do this?
Well, we listen to these musical tributes, if you will, to honor significant numbers related to Social Security. So we start with 1935, which is the year that Social Security started. We look back 40 years ago this week, and in the next break, we're going to take a look back 35 years ago. 40 years refers to something in the Social Security Code called 40 elapsed years, which is part of the original calculation that leads to your 35 computational years. And not many people really pay attention to the 40-year measurement anymore because the 35 computation years are really the important years that go into your AMI, your average indexed monthly earnings calculation, which leads to the ever important PIA, or primary insurance amount, which is that amount you will be paid on a monthly basis when you claim your retirement benefit as of your full retirement age, which for most people is age 66, but we're just on the cusp of the of people realizing that their retirement age, their full retirement age for Social Security, is going to start inching upwards towards 67. That happens for people born between 1955 and 1960. So we're right on the cusp. Right now, people who are turning 66, they are reaching their full retirement age. But assuming we're going to keep doing the show for a few more years, we'll have to start talking about 66 in 2 months, 66 in 4 months, etc. That's why we look. These songs all have some weird connection to Social Security. And in the fourth segment, we're going to get an update on what's new with helpwithmysocialsecurity.com.
Excellent.
Our fascinating and award-winning.
Award-winning? Who gave us an award?
Social Security blog.
Who gave us an award?
Well, my mom.
Did your mom give you anything else? A little star for your forehead?
Cupcake every once in a while on my birthday.
So your mom really did that?
She loves me.
I'm sure she
does. So what are you working on over there?
Okay, I was looking up something else on QLAX, and I thought I can't do it because you'll kill me. This will end up turning into QLAX Part 4.
Yeah, no.
So let's get on to a next email.
Excellent.
And if that listen, if that listener, because she had a two-part question. So that was actually one email, but two questions. Mm-hmm. One on the Social Security issue and the other on the taxation of the lump sum distribution from the QLAX. If she has any other questions, please, we'd be more than happy. Send us another email and we will get to it. But hopefully that added some clarity for her. Okay, this next email came in on August 11th. And I know we answered other emails ahead of it. I just kind of print these emails out. I put them on the desk. We record in an office in my office. We took one of the offices and turned it into a recording studio. It's not an office anymore. And every time I get an email, Chris, I just right-click it and press that quick print button. And then staff knows that if it's an email question, they grab it, they come in here, and they put it on the desk. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of gets buried under the microphone with all the other ones. And we kind of answered others ahead. No, we didn't miss it. It was always here on the desk. We just never got to it.
Okay.
Right. We don't answer these necessarily in order received, but order that I happen to pick them up off the desk.
Very scientific.
So that's why this one came in on the 11th and we hadn't answered it yet. Excuse me. But it's an interesting email because it gets into tax diversification, which is something we've talked about before, but not very...
What?
Tax diversification. Hmm. So a lot of people don't factor that in their retirement planning. So you have no clue what this is. And people who think we're making this up, if Pete was here, he'd agree. Chris, I never pretty much tell you anything.
Not so much, no.
On what we're going
to... So this is, it stays fresh that way because then I get to hear the questions right along.
Right, so he has no clue. The emails come to me, they don't go to him.
Yeah, so he gets to ponder them for a while. I get to just spontaneously react.
I simply right-click, press print. Staff puts it on the desk under my microphone, and there it sits until we decide to answer it. So on this one, tell me what you think. It's interesting. It's not necessarily a question, an opinion. She's asking for an opinion. Mm-hmm. But they address it to you as well. Hi, Jim and Chris.
Well, very nice.
Which is rare because usually
I'm usually forgotten.
You are. Mm-hmm. Hi, Jim and Chris. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you guys for an entertaining show. My husband is a 53-year-old college professor with access to low-cost 403B plan. His and our income is approximately $250,000 a year, including salary, consulting income, and dividends and interest. He contributes $18,000 a year to his 457B plan and $24,000 to his traditional 403B account.
So he's pretty much maxing out the contributions to those accounts.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And let me just, for listeners who don't know, because these are really accounts that apply to the realm of academia. What he obviously is a college professor. A 457 account is just a type of salary deferral account, and a 403B is a... kind of like a 401k equivalent for governmental and nonprofits. Mm-hmm. Just the easiest way to describe them. We see them all the time in academia to have a 403b with a 457. He also, she also writes, his employer makes a very generous 9% match, or approximately an additional $21,000 per year. So he's saving quite a bit. Let's add this up, Chris. $18,000, $24,000, and $21,000. What do we get? You got your handy dandy calculator.
$63,000.
You did that all in your head.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty darn good. Now divide by pi.
12.
Sure. See, I got you on that one.
Exactly.
You're all proud of yourself adding those numbers up in your head, but you couldn't divide it by pi.
Right.
Okay. So he has about $63,000 a year being saved. Chris, can you think of one problem right now that they're creating?
They are piling up a whole bunch of pre-tax income, pre-tax savings, if you will, in these accounts that will at one point have to be distributed and be taxed. And if they pile up a huge enough amount in there, those amounts are going to come out, will be taxed at maybe higher tax bracket levels than they might prefer. And they're completely exposing themselves, essentially, to taxes in their retirement during those years.
Exactly. Now, remember, we know the husband is 53. The woman who wrote this, I'm assuming, is the wife. She doesn't indicate her age. Let's just say she's 50. So he's 53, she's 50. Essentially, the 50 and 53-year-old couple is sticking the tax bite to the 70 and 73-year-old them, or the 80 and 83-year-old them, or the 90 and 93-year-old them. They're not solving anything. They are sticking the tax bill to the older them. The younger them doesn't want to pay the taxes. They're going to make the older them pay it.
Which I will say the classic or traditional approach using these tax deferred accounts, which is what these are, and that's what you would consider a 401k and an IRA as well, is a tax deferral. You're not avoiding the taxes. You're just not paying them now in order to pay them later. Instead, the concept that was kicked around that's been pretty much dismissed, and we talk about that quite a lot, is that you're tax rates should be lower in retirement than they are during your years of work. Well, they're generating a quite substantial amount of money in these accounts. So once they start to distribute the money, particularly when they don't have control over the distributions, which is once they reach required minimum distribution age of 70 and a half, they might be faced with being pushed with nothing they can do about it into a higher tax bracket than they would like. Now, they're in a fairly high tax bracket right now.
Right, and we're going to get into that because that's what she's alluding. I say alluding too much. Mm-hmm. One of
you do.
iTunians pointed that out to us.
Well, he suggested we create a drinking game.
Yes.
Where every time Jim says alluding or alluded or allude,
we take a shot.
But when I analyzed one of the shows, I knew we wouldn't make it past about the second segment without having to call an ambulance.
We'd be hammered.
Right.
So that's kind of like the drinking show growing up with the Bob Newhart. Every time someone said, hi, Bob, you had to take a drink.
Same deal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we'll skip that part. Okay, because this is fascinating. I can pretty much tell you all if you're waiting to hear what to do with an RMD you don't need, that ain't going to happen on today's show. That's going to have to be something else because I can really get into this.
Okay.
Trust me. You think QLAX? I could stretch this to four shows, but I won't. But there's a lot moving here, and you hit the nail on the head. Because like we say, when everything's a hammer, the world's a nail or something like that. And you hit that right on the head. So then she writes, we have a small, she says, I have a small IRA and a very small Roth IRA, but do not work and have not made any contributions to those in recent years. And then she puts, depending on his consultant, he being his husband, depending on his consulting income, an additional $6,500 is contributed to a backdoor Roth. So let's just assume he's putting $63,000 a year into tax-deferred accounts that will be subject to income taxes, will be subject to required minimum distributions, will be subject later in life. They, again, the 53-year-old husband is sticking the tax bill to the 63, 73, 83, 93-year-old him. And we're guessing she's 50. I'm just making that totally up. So it's people in their early 50s are sticking the tax bill to people in their 80s and 90s. And they're putting a small amount, $6,500, into what she has termed the backdoor Roth. First of all, there's no such thing as a backdoor Roth. It's not the name. Hey, I'm going to open up a backdoor Roth. What they're doing is they earn too much money to put money into a Roth IRA as a contribution. So they're taking $6,500 and putting it into a traditional IRA and then converting it into a Roth IRA. And that's how they're getting money into a Roth.
So it's still a regular Roth. They're putting money in a Roth just through a back door.
Now, what I don't have, because I don't have my calculator with me, and I should have figured this out, they are essentially contributing about $67,500 to a their retirement.
Which is about a third of their income.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And just about, according to my math, 8.5% is in a tax-free account.
Right. So they've already paid tax on a very small amount. But now, to their defense, they don't really have access to other after-tax options in traditional accounts you might have at an employer-sponsored plan. Those employer-sponsored plans are all tax-deferred.
You haven't read the email yet.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. They're offering a Roth?
Yeah, that was part of her question.
Okay.
So you should wait for me to finish.
Most employers. Right.
Now you know for sure, listeners, yeah. Chris doesn't see these emails ahead of time. Okay. So currently, our money is divided as follows. 50% in a taxable account. That, folks, would be like money in the bank, money in a brokerage account, things of that nature. 40% in tax deferred. This kind of tells me that they've just recently started saving at these levels. If they have half their money in non-retirement accounts and they're contributing $63,000 a year to retirement accounts, they're just starting to save for their retirement relatively recently.
Accounts, yeah.
Correct. So 40% in tax deferred accounts and 10% in Roth IRA accounts. Although my husband does not have a retirement date in mind, I would not be surprised if he works well into his 70s.
Mm.
So let's just say he's going to work to 75.
Mm-hmm.
Just going to make that up. At his at his age, we currently pay 28% federal taxes. They're in the 28% federal bracket. Mm-hmm. And 6% state taxes. They live in a high tax state. 6% state taxes. My impression is that he should probably contribute to the traditional plan as he is. However, do you think it would be worthwhile to contribute to his Roth 403B? As long as we stay in the 28% federal bracket for diversification's sake. Thank you. I appreciate both your thoughts. So she wants your thoughts, too. Mm-hmm. Here's my take. Yes, they need to look not only. Remember what I say all the time, listeners and Chris? I may be talking to the 53-year-old you. I am advocating for the 73, 83, and 93-year-old you. And all too often, people fixate on one thing. If I put money in this account today, Chris, I could deduct it on my taxes. Mm-hmm. I will save money today. Great. You're just sticking the bill to the older you. That's what the government does every day when we borrow something like, what is it, $4 billion a day we borrow in this country. We're just sticking the bill to the older us. Today's generation, today's government wants to spend the money, but they're going to stick paying it back to the future generations.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what's going on here. Now, I have a few questions. How do they have more money in taxable accounts and not tax-deferred accounts? Okay, they waited a little while to save. But I don't know, but if they're putting $63,000 a year and they're going to do this for another 22 years, their tax-deferred account, that will probably, their IRA accounts and 401ks, people, they're probably going to become 80% of their assets in the future. It may be 50-40-10 today, 50% in brokerage accounts, 40% in tax qualified retirement accounts, and 10% in tax-free Roths. But they're putting $63,000 a year into the tax-deferred accounts. And he's going to work well into his 70s. He's only 53. Unless they have a hell of a lot of money in this tax-deferred brokerage account, I bet you 70-80% of their money later in retirement is going to be in accounts subject to taxes.
Mm-hmm. Which, if, there's a big if, they end up in retirement in a lower tax bracket than they are today, you might point to that as a good idea.
Exactly, and that's how most CPAs look mm-hmm. at it. Let's go to the numbers. Mm-hmm. So right now, they make $250,000 a year. Mm-hmm. But he's putting $63,000 in accounts that he's not paying taxes. So he has probably taxable income of, and let's just say they take the standard deduction and personal exemption. I have no idea. He probably has taxable income, and I'm trying to crunch these numbers in my head, but just about $200,000 of taxable income. No, a little less, a lot less than that. Excuse me.
Like 140.
Yeah, because if they're making 250 and he's putting 63,000 folks into a account where he can deduct it now, that brings him to 190. The personal exemption and standard deduction is going to knock off about another 20K. So that's going to push him down to around 170, which fits the 28% bracket. Mm-hmm. 140 would put him in 25. She has said they're in the 28 bracket. Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm guessing, and again, these are back of the envelope. In fact, these are back of my mind. If Chris will tell you, I don't even have a pen in my hand or an envelope I'm scratching this on.
Which is the scary part.
Which is the scary part. Mm-hmm. So I'm just assuming maybe they have about $170,000 of taxable income. Mm-hmm. That puts them in the 28% bracket. They're in the 28% bracket by 20 plus thousand. Any married couple with more than $151,900 of taxable income, not gross income, folks, taxable income, will be in the 28% bracket. So maybe as little as $20,000, $25,000 of their pay is being taxed at 28%. The rest is being taxed at 25%. They are no way in the 15% bracket. That is a taxable income of $75,000 or less. So maybe in some given years they could be in the 25, but right now I feel pretty confident they're in the 28. But let's project this going forward. Chris, you're going to have to take out your you don't use an HB12C. You have your Texas Instrument thing there. Mm-hmm. Let's just, again, make up some number. I don't know. Let's just say he has $200,000 already in his retirement accounts. And he's putting in $63,000 for 23 more years. Let's get him to 70. No, I was right, 22 more years. We're going to get him to 75 because he's going to work well into his 70s. $63,000 a year for 22 years going into a retirement account with a current balance of $200,000, and we're making the current balance up. We have no idea what it is. And let's just say it earned 6% a year. Mm-hmm. What is the net result of that going to be?
You'll have almost $3.5 million in there. That's assuming over those 20 years those contributions don't grow. That's just keeping straight at $63,000, which I would guess is...
That's not even at a 6% a year?
And that's a 6% okay. too. You got the 6% in there, but you're not growing the contributions.
Oh,
yeah, you're not increasing the contributions. Never,
right, and chances are he would increase them.
Right.
But you're looking at about $3.5 million?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he retires and he's now 75. I will look up the uniform lifetime table. I should have had that. I apologize. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to...
So what we're headed for here while he's looking that up is to try to figure out what will be the required minimum distribution just out of these accounts. This isn't going to count any other earnings he might have if he continues to consult or if he has other types of taxable earnings in his brokerage account with dividends or capital gains or those sorts of things. But
right. What is he going to have to take out of this? Mm-hmm. And let's just assume, again, he grew to $3.5 million or whatever Chris said. Mm-hmm. He retires at 75. He now has to start taking required minimum distributions. He doesn't while he's still working there, unless he owns 5% or more of the university that he works at, and I doubt he does. So now they're starting to take required minimum distributions, and his first divisor at age 75 is 22.9.
I fumble-fingered it, but the answer is $153,000.
Okay, his first year RMD, folks, $153,000. Add to that Social Security, which could be fairly high, another $30,000, $40,000 between him and his
any,
wife.
Although if he's been in academics the entire time, he wouldn't have any
they
of
may
that.
Not. Well, some do, some don't.
Some
we don't
some
know.
Don't.
We don't know. So I have no idea if he's going to have Social Security. We'll give him that. But she did say they're already getting interest and dividends and consulting income. So let's just say they make another $50,000 on top of that through interest, dividends, consulting income, Social Security, annuity income, pension. We don't know a lot of these other numbers. I just know the RMD is going to be $153,000 alone. So you see where I'm going with this, Chris?
I do.
Okay, now they're retired, making maybe around $150,000, let's call it $200,000, as we said. How much of that $200,000 can they put in a tax-deferred account to deduct on their taxes as a retiree?
None.
Hmm. So that means they have no way of shielding anything?
Nope.
So you see where we're going with this, listener? Now you are knee-deep at $153,000 and a married couple, you're almost right at the 28% tax bracket. Granted, you'll have a standard deduction and personal exemption that would push you back down into the 25 bracket. But if you have any type of Social Security, consulting income, interest, dividends, annuity, or pension, boom, Chris, they're in the 28% bracket.
And that's assuming that the brackets are still 28 when you get there.
Correct. We don't know what they'll be. They could be 35 by then, or maybe they'll cut taxes. I don't know. But when we come back, the other thing I'm going to get into that they're not looking at is what happens when one of them passes away. I'm going to get into that next because you're going to see a huge widower's penalty for them. Mm-hmm. And I think they're going to be very interested in maxing out that 401k, the 403b Roth option when I get into the widower's penalty because no one ever talks about that.
Correct. So here we are. We are at the last break of the show. When we come back, we're going to hear the number one song from 35 years ago this week. I'll tell you right now, the number one song actually is Endless Love, which is number one for like 900 weeks in a row. So we're going to mix it up a little bit, and we're going to hear something else in the top 10 from this week 35 years ago in 1981. A far, in my opinion, far superior song to Endless Love. No offense meant to Lionel Richie, but we'll find out what that song is when we come back from this short break.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That is, in fact, the best song this week, in my opinion. That's one of the top songs from this week in 1981, which was 35 years ago this week. That, of course, is Urgent by Foreigner. Made it to number four, so never hit number one, surprisingly. This is a great song. So Foreigner, just those of you who don't know, the name came from the fact that the group was made up of half Americans and half British. So no matter where they were in the world on tour, someone was considered a foreigner. And that's where the name comes from. At least that's the rumor. I never validate any of these, double-check these, but I'll trust Teen that that's the truth. So why do we do this? We do this, like I mentioned before, as kind of an honor or a lead-in for our update on what's new with helpwithmysocialsecurity.com.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
Well, this week we have a post related to the previous week's post. The previous week's post was a refresher, if you will, on retroactive benefits. This week is a bit of a warning, and that warning is, to summarize, would be that the Social Security Administration has a policy that when you come in and claim your Social Security after your full retirement age, their default recommendation and their default way of filling out the paperwork is to file retroactively for you. And that might sound great. You go in and they're going to give you a retroactive lump sum of up to 6 months' worth of benefits in one lump. But it isn't free. That's not just a gift. Essentially, they're going to give you that instead of the higher monthly benefit payment that you would receive by not filing retroactively. So if your goal, and that may be fine for some of you, maybe you're going to use that for a trip or for something else, and that's totally fine. The trade-off makes sense to you. But if your goal was to maximize your benefit, which usually is the case when we're talking about a married couple and they're concerned about leaving the biggest survivor benefit for the surviving spouse in case one of them dies. If the goal is to maximize, don't let them retroactively file for you. And there's been a number of people that have found themselves accidentally in that position, and they get kind of blinded by the excitement. They're going to receive 6 months worth of benefits in one lump sum. So they might receive, tens of thousands of dollars, and that sounds great, but it's not free. There is a cost to that, and that is the fact that they're backdating the application date, and therefore that does rob you, if you will, some of your delayed retirement credits that you might otherwise be entitled to. So that's what's new on this week's HelpWithMySocialSecurity.com.
What's new, pussycat?
Excellent. Okay, did you want to add anything before I get into what are your thoughts on their situation?
Well, so far, the situation, they are, to their credit, building up a large nest egg. At this pace, they are saving a substantial amount of their current salary. So maybe they're doing that because they did start saving a bit late and trying to play catch-up, which they're being very aggressive. And I think when he added it up, it looked like they're saving about 30% of their income. So they're going to make up a lot of time, especially when it sounds like the plan might be to work all the way until 75. So that actually benefits you, any generic retiree, not this particular couple necessarily, but the longer you work, two beneficial things happen. You have more money coming in, and you delay having to drain your retirement accounts, and you can be making contributions into those retirement accounts, and the number of years you will live in retirement is going to be reduced. Because I don't know what your day of mortality will be, but I can guarantee you the longer you work and wait, however many days you have left on this planet, fewer of them will be in retirement the longer you work. So I guess that's one significant way, actually, to increase your odds of a financially successful retirement, and that is to work longer. Most people aren't interested in working to 75 necessarily, or might be in a job or a career that they can't physically work until 75. Academics are one area, and this is one thing that I find a bit attractive about teaching, is that if I choose to or need to, I can probably work until 70 or maybe even beyond without a whole lot of trouble, because there's any number of professors I know that have gone past that. And hopefully I won't have to do it. And the only reason I will do it is because I choose to. But certainly if I was in a more physically strenuous type of a job, that wouldn't be an option for me. So that's one advantage to those types of jobs, which our listener, our emailer, is in that position as well.
Okay. So what I want people to look at and what I want our listener to look at, she doesn't have any right now. She claimed there was 50% of their money in a brokerage accounts, 10% of their money in Roth accounts. Both of those accounts, which represents about 60% of their assets, receives, I think, quite favorable tax treatment. She doesn't get any current deduction for putting money into those, but the older her, the future them, the 70, 80, 90-year-old them, have much better tax planning strategies with a Roth and with a regular brokerage account. Because on a regular brokerage account, they can use capital losses. They can use capital loss carry forwards. They can use capital losses against ordinary income. They've got a lot of benefits there.
And when they sell something in order to live off of it, the entire amount is not taxed, only the amount of any possible gain there.
Right, and they can manipulate losses to offset gains. A lot of planning you can do there. However, they are saving $63,000 a year in the husband's retirement accounts. And Chris and I just kind of estimated that $63,000 a year for 22 years, growing at 6% on average, could be worth $3.5 million or more inside their retirement accounts. Chances are they could have even more. If the earnings are higher, and there's no guarantee, of course, on earnings, they could have less if the earnings were less. But chances are, as his pay goes up, so will those contribution amounts, because they're based on a percent of salary. So more money is going in. And then we did a simple calculation. Under today's rules, how much would the required minimum distribution be if he was to retire at age 75? Chris came out that he would have an estimated RMD of $153,000 in the first year under current rules. So that's some significant distribution. The other thing that we pointed out, that's now $153,000 with absolutely no type of deductions they can take. They can't take that $153,000 RMD and say, I'm going to put $50,000 of it in this IRA over here and not pay taxes on it. You hit the end of the road. You've kicked that tax can as far as you could, and now it's time to pay the piper. Okay. The other thing, what we don't know, is are they going to have any type of additional income that they have to factor in? Are they going to have any Social Security income, any type of pension income, any type of annuity income? How much interest and dividends will they be getting? Will they have any more consulting income? So it's quite possible they could have more than $153,000 of income in retirement. So we just said, what if they had $200,000, that they did have other sources of income? What tax bracket are they going to be in?
Well, they'll be basically what we usually see. More often than not, people end up in about the same tax bracket as they did when they were working. And that makes sense if you really think about it. In order to support a lifestyle that they've established while working, they need income to a degree that will maintain that lifestyle. And that income is going to be about what they were doing before. Now, where it comes from and what taxes to do, with some planning, that can be manipulated to your benefit. And the time to do that is early on, not after you reach 75. Now your hands are tied. There's not much you can do at that point. But before that, things you can do.
So why don't we can play devil's advocate here. Let's just say there are no other forms of income coming into them.
Yep.
That they just get $153,000 in the first year
RMD.
RMD. Okay. So now they're getting $153,000. They will be able to deduct from that. Let's just assume there's no more mortgage. They don't get a mortgage interest. They're going to be able to take from that the standard deduction and personal exemption. I know the standard deduction for a married couple is $12,600 right now. The standard deduction, I'm trying to find that.
$3,900?
I'm trying to find it here. Standard deduction for deduction, single. Personal exemption, $4,050.
Oh,
Close.
So they can deduct from 53,000, Chris.
153.
Mm-hmm. 12,000. This is if this was happening today, folks, because we got to look at it in today's dollars. Mm-hmm. 12,600 standard deduction, and then 4,050 for him, 4,050 for her personal exemption. Mm-hmm. What's their taxable income?
132.
Okay. So what we're doing here is we're helping them take the devil's advocate here. They get no other form of income in retirement, just the RMDs. That is it. I personally think that's not going to be the case, that they will have more. Mm-hmm. But even if it
And they'll probably, even if to maintain their lifestyle, they may have to take out more. Even though the RMD is only 153, that doesn't mean you're limited to taking that amount, especially when they look at how much taxes they're going to owe to maintain their lifestyle. They might have to ratchet up their distributions beyond the 153. That's certainly possible.
But let's just assume they only have to take out 153.
Yep.
With the standard deduction and personal exemption, their taxable income is what, Chris?
132.
132. Puts them in the 25% bracket. Mm-hmm. Anything below 151.9, let's call it 152,000, they're in the 25. Mm-hmm. So essentially, let's just assume they will be as a married couple in the 25% bracket in retirement, and today as a married couple, they're in the 25% bracket. 28% bracket.
Mm-hmm. So there are a little bit of difference there.
Now, a CPA will say, well, hey, they're going to be in a lower bracket.
Yep.
Makes much more sense for the 53-year-old them to stick the tax bill to the 73, 83, and 93-year-old them because they're going to pay less in taxes.
Right, and this is traditional thought process here.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they're asking, should we stop putting 63,000 as we are and direct some of that money into the Roth 403B? The Roth option, listeners, on a 403B Roth, their earnings limit doesn't apply. They don't have to do the backdoor Roth IRA strategy. And he could direct into his Roth. Remember, she told us in the email, I'm trying to find the email here. They told us in the email he is putting into his Roth, excuse me, into his 403B, $24,000. And that lets them deduct that on their taxes. But should they stop that and put that $24,000 into the Roth option?
Essentially paying 28% taxes on that at the federal level and 6% at the state level in anticipation of, you know, right now if they put it in the 403B, it's going to be taxed at, say, 25% in the future.
Now, if we look at just that, if we assume, again, in retirement, the required minimum distributions will start at $153,000 and they have no other sources of income, no interest, no dividends, no Social Security, no pension, no annuity, no consulting income, no other income in retirement. But their RMD, you can't ignore those folks, their RMD, required minimum distributions, will be about $150,000 in year one, applying this, the tax rules as they exist today, they would have taxable income of about 132. They will be in the 25% bracket. So putting money into that Roth option
doesn't seem to make sense.
Why would they put money into the Roth option and have to pay taxes at the 28% bracket to take it out in retirement at the 25%? Well, if you simply look at it from that standpoint, which most CPAs do, and there's nothing against them, they're brilliant people, but financial planners, especially retirement planners like Chris and I, we may be talking to the 53-year-old you, we are advocating for the 73, 83, and 93-year-old you. My problem is this, Chris, assuming everything we said, and you can see I'm really warping this to look good in the sense of you're not going to have any more income in retirement. This is it. I have a feeling they're going to have Social Security, pension, annuity, interest, dividends, or consulting income. There's going to be some combination of that. Even if they didn't, even if tax brackets don't rise or don't drop and the rules stay fairly similar to today, they could be in the 25% bracket. So no, listener, putting money into the Roth 403B in this scenario wouldn't make sense. But the problem is what, Chris?
What if one of them passes away?
That's the issue. If he passes away before the wife, let's just play devil's advocate mm-hmm. here because men generally pass away first. Mm-hmm. She gets the privilege of inheriting his entire retirement account. Mm-hmm. And again, I have to make an assumption here that she's 50, he's 53. I have no idea. She could be 60, she could be 40. I don't know. But let's just assume 50, and we know he's 53. She's told us. She will inherit his entire retirement account, but her RMD is going to be any lower?
No.
No.
Essentially going to be the same.
They're the same because she gets to inherit it all. Mm-hmm. The way RMDs work, the divisor is identical. The only way the RMDs could be slightly lower is if she is more than 10 years younger than him. Mm-hmm. That's it. And it's possible maybe she's only in her 40s and he's 53. So the RMDs might be a little bit smaller, but not meaningfully smaller. So the RMDs, listener, is going to be the same, but now it's just her, is it not?
It is.
Now she's single. Mm-hmm. Now, the first year of death, you can still file, and then you can get that special widowers for the next mm-hmm. 2 years.
So you can file for a bit, as effectively as married filing jointly, like they had been when they were married.
And your tax brackets will be the same, but mm-hmm. what you're not factoring in, listener, is the minute that goes, which is about year three after death, you are now single, making, and by then the RMDs will rise. So let's just say, now let's go back to the calculator. Mm-hmm. Let's just say now, keep the IRA at the same level. We're gonna again, try to make this look as simple as possible. Let's just pretend, Chris, that there was no growth in the IRA. It's mm-hmm. still $3.5 million. Mm-hmm. But now we have to go to the uniform lifetime table, and let's just assume she was 50 and he passes away. He retires at 75. So in our calculation, she's 3 years younger. She's 72. No, he retires at 75. She is 72. He dies 10 years later. Does that sound reasonable? Just 10 sure. years later? Okay. So she is now 82. Her first distribution will be a divisor of 17.1.
That's $205,000.
Did you hear that, listener? Your RMD in year one is $205,000. Now, she doesn't have two standard deductions and two personal exemptions. She has one. Mm-hmm. She has one standard deduction, which is what, about $6,300? Mm-hmm. And a standard deduction of $4,000. Mm-hmm. What's her taxable income?
Well, I erased it now, but about $190, I think. So what, six and four, that's 10? About $195,000.
$195,000. As a single person, oh, darn, you're in the 33% tax bracket.
Oh, darn.
Did you hear that, listener? You now, as a widower, are in the 33% tax bracket. And this is assuming there was no Social Security income, no consulting income, no interest, no dividends, no annuity, no pension. Your husband left you just his very large set of 457 and 403B accounts, because the 53-year-old him and the 50-year-old you, and again, we're just assuming you're 50, were sticking the tax bill to the older you. Now, the older you is getting $190,000 of taxable income. Great problem to have.
True.
But now you are a widower, listener. And that puts you squarely in the 33% tax bracket, not the 25. Your taxes just went up when you become a widower or a widower. So what I try to get people to look at is, don't look at the brackets you are today. Don't just look at the brackets you are both going to be as a married couple. One of you are going to pass away. And you have to look at the bracket and the future required minimum distributions you will be subject to. And you are going to get nailed in taxes.
And we haven't even talked about the other side effects of having lots of income in retirement, as it affects Medicare premiums, taxability of Social Security.
Absolutely.
All of those side benefits, if you will.
Her
benefits,
Medicare premiums
penalty,
will be in Tier 3 practically. Yeah. People don't know Medicare premiums as of several years ago are now means tested. She's going to get much higher, significantly higher Medicare premiums. If there was any Social Security, it's going to be subject to taxes, obviously. But more importantly, you're going to be in a higher bracket as a widow or widower. My suggestion to you is your husband should be maxing out the $24,000 into the Roth 403B. And again, just don't look at it and, oh, I'm in the 28% bracket today, and I know for sure I'm going to be in the 25% bracket in the future. Look at what happens when one of you die first. And unless you run out and get married again just to save on taxes, you're going to get nailed on taxes. And so many people, Chris, don't factor that in.
That plus, if you're putting in these after-tax accounts like the Roths, you can effectively save more spendable cash for later because you can pay the taxes out of other income that you've got. So if you pay the taxes and still max out the contributions, the amount you actually have available to spend and buy things in retirement is higher than if you still have, if you leave the taxes for later. So there's, you know, they're already saving a significant amount, so I don't have to really give them the speech about saving for retirement, it appears, because it's a lot going in there. But for other people, you can really make up a lot more ground with Roth accounts than with traditional accounts.
Absolutely. I love Roth IRAs. I love Roth 401ks. I love Roth 403bs. Tax-free beats taxable any day. But what I want our listeners to know, and someday we'll try dedicating a whole show to the widow-widower's penalty, so much of what we do as retirement planners here differs so greatly from advisors who concentrate, Chris, on accumulation planning. They just look at where they are today. And the same thing with tax preparers, enrolled agents, CPAs, or just a regular preparer, or someone who's a do-it-yourselfer. They look at today. They don't look at where they're going to be in the future. They're not predicting what required minimum distributions are going to be. They're not factoring in the loss of a standard deduction and personal exemption at the death of one spouse and the pushing into the higher brackets because you are now a widow or a widower. And you end up paying more in taxes. Don't let the tax tail wag the dog. You have to look at not only where you are today, but where you're going to be in the future. And in my opinion, again, I did this on, I can't even say on the back of an envelope. I didn't have an envelope. We did this in our minds, but to me, it makes sense. They should be maxing out the Roth 403B. Do you agree or not?
Typical tax diversification.
Absolutely.
Don't pile everything into one type of account that is going to be exposed to the same type of taxes. Spread it out through time and through different types of taxable income.
And don't let the younger you stick the tax bill to the older you.
At least not all of it. So thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with another show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.